final debate of this election season, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton there.
You have very different ideas about how to get the economy growing faster. Secretary Clinton, in your plan, government plays a big role.
I want us to have the biggest jobs program since World War II. I think we can compete with high-wage countries.
Mr. Trump, why will your plan create more jobs and growth than Secretary Clinton?
So my plan, we're going to renegotiate trade deals. Our jobs are being taken out by the deal that her husband signed, NAFTA, one of the worst deals ever. Our jobs are being sucked out of our economy.
I've made it very clear, we are going where the money is. We are going to ask the wealthy and corporations to pay their fair share.
We will create an economic machine, the likes of which we haven't seen in many decades, and people will again go back to work, and they'll make a lot of money, and we'll have companies that will grow and expand and start from new.
I want us to do more to help small business. I want us to raise the national minimum wage, and I sure do want to make sure women get equal pay for the work we do. I want to make college debt-free.
The national debt. Why are both of you ignoring this problem?
I pay for everything I'm proposing.
I've been waiting for years. Nobody does it right. And frankly, now we're going to do it right.
All right.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's been another good week for the markets. The best thing you can say is, well, stocks are up this week. Not by much, but at least they're going in a positive direction. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck in Hour 1, Tom McClellan will be joining us as we talk about the presidential election cycle. Believe it or not, how the market goes will give you a better clue as to who is going to be president. There's an 86% correlation between stock prices and who becomes the next president. We'll be discussing that and why he feels that stocks are heading higher this year and next year. He'll be here in the first hour, and also Mark Chandler will be here to talk about that flash crash in the British pound that occurred a little over a week ago and dollar strength building ahead of us. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. We've covered economic issues the last couple of months, indicating that the economy is approaching stall speed rather rapidly. There was an article this week in The Telegraph in Great Britain indicating much of the same thing by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. But surprise, surprise, there doesn't seem to be a lot of conversation about it on Wall Street, and most certainly not in the political debate. So if we head into another recession next year, this could be the trigger for another financial crisis. And you'd think we'd be talking about it. We've had the weakest recovery since World War II. So we'll look at what is going on right now in terms of discussions and the issues that are not being covered. And then we'll talk about drinking the Kool-Aid. One of the reasons why this seems to be is that the media have gone through a strange metamorphosis in which they are promoting certain viewpoints and downplaying other viewpoints and hoping that no one notices, even though a lot of people are noticing it. There's a radical change in the journalism and in the broadcast media in this country. It has actually set the tabloid tone for these debates, even as issues are going unnoticed. So let's look at the tabloid view versus what exactly they really need to be talking about. We'll do all of that today on The Big Picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And turning to Ryan Poplava, good to see you back this week, and our market wrap report. But, before we go into the catalyst this week and the news events, listeners are asking me if we are in danger of a correction here. So I think we're going to need to address that with the technical and fundamental work that you do following the financial markets. Do you really think so? Are we in danger of some kind of a correction at this point, Ryan?
Well, John, what we have is really another tight trading range in stocks, in the S&P 500 large cap index. You know, just between the top of that trading range is around 2190. And, you know, we've had support every time we've tested that summer breakout point where we reached new highs. You know, that was really post that rally after the Brexit scare when everyone said, oh, yeah, okay, we're okay. You know, that was right around 2120. So that support continues to hold. You can see similar tight trading ranges in some of the other equity indexes as well, like the NASDAQ Composite, the Dow Industrials, all showing this very narrow range. And typically, you get into these situations when there's just no agreement between the bulls or the bears, whether there's a bullish trend or a bearish trend. It's time to pause, maybe work off previous trends that maybe got overbought or oversold. And that's where we find ourselves right now. There's not enough catalysts out there. There's not a real driving theme to move, you know, just the needle in either direction of the speedometer here for the market. So that's where we're at. So John, if stocks corrected below that breakout point, just speaking from a technical standpoint, that would be a breakdown of what was previously a bullish pattern. You know, breaking out to new highs, the higher highs beget new highs. And if we were essentially to break down, and that could create a sort of a bearish omen. And I know many of the technicians I also talk to are kind of on caution. They're on standby watching to see if that takes place. If that does, then they react. Now, bulls are defending it, but they're not pressing on their convictions any higher with higher highs. There's just too much uncertainty right now to justify chasing stocks, pushing valuations higher. So in a lot of ways, John, valuations are in many ways highly correlated to sentiment. That's what we call it. It's basically talking about our attitudes over the economy, over the market, whether we're bullish or bearish. And the University of Michigan's consumer sentiment indicator is one of those that, you know, if you put that chart over the S&P, there's a very high correlation to the trends there. And it's been declining since May, but just this September, the sentiment indicator went up for the first time, largely in part due to improving expectations. So the index said basically right now things aren't that great, but we think things are going to get better. And that's typically what can create those kind of bullish, animalistic spirits in the market. And if those expectations continue to improve, I think we can see the markets continue to move higher.
So what are investors concerned about right now? I mean, things that might cause the bulls to defend stocks at, say, 2120, but at the same time cause demand to drop off instead of helping to press the stocks higher?
Yeah, I mean, bulls are defending. Why aren't they pressing? And like I said, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. One of the concerns recently is a pickup in inflation. This is kind of a new story here for the market to be concerned about. You know, wage growth continues to accelerate. We've seen that in some of the monthly reports from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. West Texas crude. Energy is a very important product. It's used in transportation of goods, plastics. It's used in virtually everything. We're very driven on crude. And the price of it has been holding recently above 50. And that was after testing 40 back in August. And the reason why we're back up here at 50 recently has been, we've discussed on the show a few times, it was that OPEC agreement to kind of maintain their level of production instead of increase it. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of skepticism whether they're actually going to do that, which has always been the case. And because, you know, it's very easy to cheat these agreements and just continue to sell oil as price continues higher. They're just going to supply it more. But regardless, you know, the news and the catalyst out there was that announcement. And then there's the inventory reports recently have been fairly bullish. Then there's, you know, the Saudi minister this week, a news item here, basically said specifically that the downturn is over. So he's making that call. And that should help. You know, he's trying to sell around $17.5 billion in bonds for the first time ever. It helps, you know, to talk up your country's main product before offering the capital markets some, you know, a little bit of paper. but anyways, Mario Draghi, you know, the president of the ECB, said this week in their policy statement that inflation is likely to pick up over the next couple of months due to energy, and he said are likely headed higher next year. You know, that, John, leads us to our second concern by investors, which is essentially interest rates. You know, since the jobs report for September came out, it wasn't bad or overly good. And in the meantime, we've seen a lot of Fed speakers come out that we need to raise interest rates. We need to raise them so we can lower them, whatever. But essentially, you know, looking at this, investors, it's been enough right now to be more concerned. The probabilities have increased. I think the probability right now for a hike in the December meeting is right now around 63.6%. If you look at the Fed futures, next month's very unlikely. Right now, probability is around, like, I think 8%. So that's causing some dislocation in the market. We're finally saying, okay, interest rates are likely going to go up pretty soon here. So we're seeing some weakness in rate-sensitive areas like high dividend-paying stocks. That's typically consumer staples, companies that pay, you know, a very huge majority of the retained earnings out in dividends. And then there's the rate-happy groups, you know, the financials. Those have been rallying since, I think, around July. Many banks got crushed after the last hike back in December when the Fed went on pause. So sentiment completely reversed on where interest rates were going, where expectations were, and the financials were a group that got hurt. Now that those expectations are coming back, well, you know, financials are strengthening. So even though the market has been going sideways for a few months, there are definitely some themes here and some definite trends that have been unfolding in the sectors. And, you know, we're also seeing that as a result of earnings, certain growth companies are being rewarded with their performance with higher stock prices, but it hasn't been enough to stir the momentum animal spirits really overall in the market. But definitely it's a stock picker's market currently right now, and a sector picker's market.
Well, we had the last of the, there were four debates if you include the vice presidential debate, but the four presidential debates, I'll call them, this week. What about the political landscape? Is this, despite all of the feuding and the nonsense that's going on, is it having any effect on the market?
Yeah, I think, you know, a couple of weeks ago when, you know, a lot of tabloids came out over Trump over the weekend regarding, you know, some of the gender stuff that was going on, that seemed to really affect the certainty towards this election, kind of in favor of Hillary. Of course, you know, looking back at the Brexit vote, that was a vote that everyone was for sure Britain, the UK was not going to leave the EU. That was the general consensus. Voting came out in the last couple of hours that completely reversed by a very small margin. And then we had, oh my gosh, uncertainty was here. So even though, you know, most of the polls right now, they are in favor of Clinton, it's anyone's best guess still. And then what are the reactions to that? What's going to happen to the economy? You know, those kinds of bets. But I think actually, what I've been reading is that there's a lot more uncertainty regarding Congress. What are the changes there between the control in the two parties? So definitely it's, you know, wait and see stance is definitely taking place with regards to those animalistic, bullish and bearish spirits right now.
Anything specific in the news that you'd say moved the market this week? Well, how about earnings announcements too? We started those last week.
Yeah, there hasn't been really anything specific, John. Nothing very exciting that's kind of jolted sentiment. You know, that the Brexit vote during the summer and the reaction to that, and then the following reaction that, okay, we're going to be okay. We're not going to know what's going on for a long time. And I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that there's still a lot of stuff going on in currencies. I mean, you know, we've seen some weakness in the euro. Gold had that big dip last week, really, which was kind of regarding what was going on in rates at the time. We've seen the 10-year treasury yields have been marching higher. Same thing in the 30. So, but there's nothing specifically that's really like this news item happened and now, you know, bullish sentiment is completely reversed or bearish sentiment is taking off or vice versa. But there is definitely some success stories going on in earnings. You know, there was an announcement by Netflix, very huge reaction in that stock, but there's been hits to forward expectations from many others. So they beat, but maybe guided down. And there's been quite a few companies doing that. It's really the same story, just different quarter. But, you know, so far looking at the earnings season, there's about 116 companies of the 500 in the S&P that have reported. 81% have reported positive earnings surprises, and about 66% have beat on sales. Those are actually really good numbers, John, with what we have thus far. Obviously, there's still a lot more to go. Another big week next week. So we continue to see the progress in earnings. But, you know, I have read, and I haven't taken a look at the Standard & Poor's Capital IQ read on what earnings has done versus the last quarter and versus a year ago, but I have read some articles recently that have talked about that there could be an end to this earnings recession this quarter. And it's looking like that's likely so far, but that in and of itself also hasn't seemed to kind of drive up the animalistic bullish sentiment here to drive stock prices higher. But, you know, I hate to say it, but you really, unless you're watching company earnings, it really hasn't been a very exciting time to be in the markets right now, good or bad.
Yeah, and that may change in the days ahead, too, with the election and just being a couple of weeks away. I think everybody will breathe a giant sigh of relief almost when this particular election's done. The Fed's meeting on the 1st and the 2nd. So all of that may have some, you know, how do I say it? It may have some influence on what it is people are talking about. Okay, Ryan Popova, good to see you back. Appreciate the report. See you again next week.
Sounds good, John. We'll talk to you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his portfolio managers, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Greetings, everyone. John Loeffler here. You know, quite often you hear Jim and me discuss on the Financial Sense News Hour what we call the new normal. But what does that all mean in the real world when it comes to navigating the world's markets and economies in what seems to be a new and steadily changing environment? Well, answering that question is the purpose of our Investment Strategy Conference, which is taking place on October 29th in San Diego. The theme of this year's conference is Approaching the Peak and the Next Financial Crisis. For more information on attending the Investment Strategy Conference and getting this information, that will be October 29th at the Del Mar Marriott in San Diego, contact us at 858-487-3939. Once again, that's 858-487-3939, or you can email Crystal at crystal@poplava.com. That's Crystal, C-R-Y-S-T-A-L, at poplava.com. Just because things are changing doesn't mean you have to be an uninformed or anxious investor.
Well, the political debates are finally over. So what is the stock market telling us about who will be our next president in the United States? In order to talk about that, I've invited Tom McClellan back on the show. And Tom, you sent me a chart of the S&P and presidential patterns. Let's talk about it. And what is the significance of this chart? What is it telling you?
Well, what the chart shows is what we call a presidential cycle pattern. To get that, you take the data for the S&P 500 and you chop it up into four-year chunks of time, and then you average together the performance over that time. It's a lot like creating an annual seasonality pattern, except that instead of 1 year, you're using 4 years. And we find that there's a big difference during election years, depending on whether you have a first-term candidate or a second-term candidate in office. So the chart that I sent you shows the version of the presidential cycle pattern for when there is a second-term candidate in office. That's important right now because the current occupant of the White House cannot, by our Constitution, run for office. So you have two new people, and the market tends not to like the idea of anything unknown and new. And so the stock market during election years tends to do more poorly, especially leading right up to the election when you have two new challengers like that.
Barron's did an article, and they said there's an 86% correlation between the stock market and who will be the next president. Now, based on looking at the market so far, in contrast to the beginning of the year, the markets are still up. In fact, some of the smaller cap indexes are up high single digits, and maybe we ought to talk about that as well, because if you look at like the S&P mid-cap 400, it's up over 9% for the year. The 600 is up almost 10% for the year. The Russell is up almost 7.4%. So, Tom, that would indicate to me that the market is basically saying Hillary Clinton's our next president. Now, is there anything in your view that could change that view?
What you're getting at is a really interesting phenomenon. The stock market tends to do well when people are thinking confidently about generally conditions in life. And when they think that way, they also tend to like whoever's in office. If people are thinking that things are going badly, that makes them not want to be buyers of stocks, and it also makes them blame whoever's in office. And so when you have an up year, it's much more likely that the incumbent party candidate will prevail. And we're seeing that in the averages of the poll numbers right now, that we have an up market for the year, and we have the incumbent party candidate, Mrs. Clinton, currently favored to win. However, I've looked at it down to a much more granular level where I look at the behavior of the daily movements of the Dow Jones Industrial Average versus the daily poll numbers. Real Clear Politics publishes their average of the poll numbers every day. And if you go to our website right now, mcoscillator.com, down at the bottom of the homepage, there's an article about how the Dow Jones Industrial Average leads the poll numbers. Right now, it's about 2 weeks lead time. And what that's really showing is that the changes in public mood toward the candidates are really happening more in real time with the stock market, but there's a lag in terms of when those are tabulated by each of the different polls, and then when those average poll numbers are tabulated together by Real Clear Politics and reported. So that's why you show up with about a two-week lag time. In order to get a Trump victory from here, it looks like we're going to have a meaningful decline down into late October to early November, which would not only cause but also reflect a change in the mood. If people are happy, they like the incumbent. If people are unhappy because the stock market's down, or the stock market's down because people are unhappy, then that changes the poll numbers. I realize that I'm engaging in a little bit of circular logic about who's the driver, but it doesn't really matter in terms of which one is driving the other. What we see is that we can track the movements of the poll numbers by watching the Dow Jones Industrial Average, what it was doing 2 weeks before. So we should know a lot more closely as we get right up to the week before the election. I've been able to correctly predict the outcome of the last four elections using this method of tracking the Dow Jones Industrial Average versus the poll numbers going all the way back to 2000. People forget that back in 2000, George W. Bush was up by as much as 13 points in late October. The Friday before the election, he was up by 6 points, but based on what I had seen in the movements of the Dow, I published in my newsletter that the election would be too close to call. And indeed, for 6 weeks, it was too close to call in 2000. We also saw the big stock market decline in late 2008 favored the then new challenger party, which was then Senator Obama, and the stock market and the poll numbers tracked each other very much in lockstep with about a 1 week lag, because it takes a while to gather the poll numbers and report them. So that's something that we'll be reporting on in our newsletter and as we get closer. But it's a little bit too far away right now to be able to make a determination about the outcome of a vote that's still 3 weeks away.
So if I was a betting man, I should look at your newsletter a week before the election.
Definitely so. If you were going to be betting on the stock market direction, you'd want to look at it more often than that.
Okay. Well, let's just take a look at those numbers following this logic. If I look at the Dow, the S&P, the Russell, year to date, those numbers are up. So the stock market is up this year. If I look at those indexes over the last 30 days, the Dow's down a little over 1%. The S&P 500 is down 1.6%. So all the indexes, with the exception of the transportation, are down over the last month. But what you're saying, it's more in line with what's going to happen 1 or 2 weeks before the election than, let's say, where the Dow is now.
That's correct. We need to be a little bit closer to the election to know how the Dow is behaving in order to get the insight for which way the poll numbers are going to zig and zag at the last minute. Right now, in that chart that I sent you, the stock market is tracking the dance steps of that presidential cycle pattern for when you have a second-term president in office. It's not following it with the same magnitudes, but the ups and downs and the timing of the turns are matching up. And so by that logic, we should see another bottom due around October 28th, and then the potential for a bounce. How low that bottom goes is not something that this tool does a very good job of telling us, but it says that we should see one, and so that the bounce that we saw this week, the two up days, it's probably over and we're going to roll over and make another low.
Tom, when you see things like this as we get closer to the election, and especially in this one, you have two candidates that have completely divergent views in terms of what they want to do with the economy. One wants more taxes and regulation. The other one wants less taxes and regulation. And we know that the stock market is in many times a casino. So there are going to be bets that are going to be made before the election takes place in terms of the likely outcome. Like, in other words, there might be certain sectors or stocks that would do well under a Clinton presidency versus, let's say, a Trump presidency. So shouldn't we see a little bit more volatility or rotation as we get closer to the election? For example, industrial stocks or capital equipment stocks, because both candidates are talking about major infrastructure spending. So that would tend to favor capital equipment type stocks. if Trump got in, he would probably be more favorable towards pharmaceutical stocks versus, let's say, Hillary Clinton. So do you expect to see these kind of rotational changes in sectors as we get closer to the election, as people start placing bets?
Well, the betting odds right now are something like 81% in favor of Mrs. Clinton winning. So if things suddenly changed as we get closer to the election, then a lot of investors who are making the types of bets that you're talking about would suddenly have to reevaluate their stances. And yes, we could get some volatility in sectors, not necessarily in the overall market, as people suddenly start changing those bets. But that assumes that we get a swing in the polls, and that assumes a few other things that we don't know yet. If Mrs. Clinton were to win, for example, she probably would not do what Mr. Trump would do as a brand new president, which all brand new presidents seem to do if they're from a different party. They spend the first year in office discovering that, oh my gosh, things are even worse than I told you, and that the only solution is whatever radical plan that they want to do. When President Clinton came into office in 1993, he declared that it was the worst recession in 50 years. Despite 5% GDP growth. And he said that the only solution was a $20 billion package of basically givebacks and rewards to his campaign contributors. And Congress said no to that. In retrospect, thinking back about $20 billion, that's such a cute little number. When Bush came into office, he implemented two different rounds of tax cuts as his version of the solution to all the problems. When President Obama came into office, we were already underway with TARP, and then he had the shovel-ready products and $800 billion worth of stimulus, which you can make arguments about on both ways about whether it helped. It certainly has driven up the debt. But every president seems to do this, and so if Trump wins, you can expect that he would probably discover that things are worse than he told you before, and the predecessors to blame, and that he's going to solve the problem. If Mrs. Clinton wins, she's probably not going to spend the first year blaming her predecessor for things all being wrong, because she's from the same party. So there's a difference in how the stock market reacts to the president talking that way. People don't like hearing that things are worse than we thought. And so that's why, generally speaking, during the first and second year of a brand new president from a brand new party, the stock market doesn't do as well as if you have an incumbent staying in office and not telling people that things are worse off than they said.
Okay, so looking beyond, let's say, this presidential election, what else are the charts telling you in terms of the condition of the market? You know, if you look at the market from a fundamental point of view, the valuations are certainly pretty high at this point. If you look at the economic numbers, GDP has been slowing down. We're now cruising at stall speeds of 1%. And we're also seeing probably this could be the sixth consecutive quarter of declining corporate profits. But given that this is still a liquidity-driven market, beyond the election cycle, November 8th, what do the charts tell you?
You're very right to point to the market being liquidity-driven. And on that basis, I'm actually really, really excited about the bullish prospects for the stock market going up into 2017 toward a huge major top due in 2018. Because I think that all the liquidity that the Fed created and left in the banking system is still out there. The ECB is still printing money, and that hasn't been working to push stock prices higher for the last 3 months. I think it's going to start working again. So I'm very excited. Part of why I'm excited is some analysis that we've done looking at crude oil prices versus the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And for the entire history of the price series of both of those sets of data, going all the way back to 1896 when the Dow was created, the Dow tends to follow in the same footsteps as crude oil prices with about a 10-year lag. It's amazing. I can't think of a good reason why it should work that way, but when you see it working for 120 years, at some point you say, okay, I guess it's working. If people can think back to the commodity bubble of 2007 and 2008, we saw oil prices peak at $145 a barrel in 2008. So we're coming up on the 10-year echo of that move in oil prices. And I'm expecting to see some version of that up move in oil prices echoed in the movements of the Dow in 2017 and 2018. After about mid-2018, though, I am very bearish on the long term for stock prices. So we got about another year and a half of really good times for stock investors. And then we start a period of really good times for market shorting experts. But for the immediate next year or so, I'm very excited about a bullish opportunity.
So going beyond the presidential election, regardless of who is our next president, based on liquidity positions, you see this market going higher and hitting new records.
I do, and I don't think the Fed is going to do much to get in the way of that, because our long-term models for inflation show that prices will still remain relatively low and calm. We're seeing huge inflation in drug costs already. That's been getting a lot of news. And medical costs generally have been going up, because that's what happens whenever the government subsidizes something more, is that the price goes up. But the cost of other things are staying relatively low, especially food items. We're having huge production of agricultural products, which is driving down costs across the board. Just bad news for farmers, but it's good for people who eat food, which is about all of us. And that is likely to continue to have an effect for about another 2 years of low inflation. At some point, though, the Fed is going to have to step in when inflation starts to bounce back, probably in late 2018 and into 2019. So you'll have a perfect storm of the Fed yanking back on their policy accommodation with interest rates at the same time when liquidity is going to be disappearing on its own. So I'm not very bullish about 2019. But we don't have to invest for 2019 today. We've got to decide what to do for the next several months. And once we get past about the week before the election, things are looking really good.
Tom, what could go wrong with that forecast? I mean, a good example were the expectations that were set about the market towards the end of last year, which changed dramatically as we entered into the first part of the year with the first 6 weeks of the year. Just about everything you could think of owning was going down. I don't care if it was commodities, bond prices, or stocks here or globally.
Well, yeah, there was a big swoon at the beginning of 2016. Which was an anomalous event, and then the market recovered from it because investors around the world collectively got into a bad mood in the first 2 weeks of January, and then they got over it, and the stock market surged higher all the way into July. So you can have those anomalous episodes like the Brexit vote, which caused a little bit of a swoon, or like the Ebola panic back in 2014. Those things come along, and when they are correct, then they can do some damage. If they are incorrect and not part of the program, then the market rebounds and gets over it right away. So if you see those in the next 6 months or so, if you see one of those anomalous swoons, look at it as an opportunity, because it's not part of what the program should be.
And there's nothing else that would cause you to change that? Like, what, for example, would happen if the Fed did something that nobody expected? Number one, in December, instead of raising rates, they pass. Or they raise rates in December, and then in January, they raise rates again.
We haven't seen that kind of behavior from the Fed going against expectations. And so I think the current Fed and its leadership really likes to manage the expectations and then follow what the expectations that they have managed. So I don't look for that being the source of one of these exogenous events. If you have Iran invading somebody, like in 1990 when Iraq decided to annex the 19th province, which we all know as Kuwait, that can throw the market for a loop. We can have that kind of event at any time. Or if Deutsche Bank actually finally collapses, we could have an episode like the collapse of Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers in 2008. But I think that the German government certainly will work hard to try to make that not happen, or at least not evident. So those are the types of exogenous events that we face at all times, you know, the risk of getting hit by a meteor. But I don't foresee any of those that are going to disrupt the path higher in 2017 in a big way.
We've seen an uptick in the dollar. Let's talk about the dollar and gold. What's your view on gold here, and also your view on the dollar?
I'm extremely bullish on gold. We've just had what I believe is the bottom of the 13.5-month cycle in gold in October. It was due in October, and it appears to have come in right on schedule. And so we're now entering the upward phase of the next 13.5-month cycle. So we'll get another bottom in gold 13.5 months from now. But in the meantime, we have the upward phase to do. And I think that's irrespective of what happens with the dollar. We Americans all think that, well, gold and the dollar will move in opposite directions. But there are more people who trade gold that think in euros, or that think in yuan or in yen, than there are people who trade gold and that think in dollars. And they're also worried about their own currency problems. So it's not just a dollar versus gold issue. It's your home currency versus gold issue. And I think that we are entering a new phase of higher prices for gold, and I'm very excited about it.
And in terms of that, do you think we take out the old highs?
Well, the 2011 high of 1900, that's a long way from here. You can have a wonderful rally that doesn't take that out, and you'd still want to catch it. But as for taking out the highs that we saw this year, yes, I do think that we should take those out. One of the things about that 13.5-month cycle is that it matters how the pattern of highs and lows occurs and unfolds during the course of that cycle. We just had the bottom of it, but what we saw during this most recent cycle is a case of what psychoanalysts call right translation. That means that the high, the price high, came late in the cycle, not at the peak of the sine wave. And so when you have right translation during one cycle, it tends to be a very bullish message for the next cycle. If, on the other hand, you had what we saw in 2012 and 13, if you had left translation where the high comes early in the cycle, that has a bearish portent for the next cycle. We have seen this year right translation, so that says very bullish things about gold during the next 13.5 month cycle, which I believe is starting right now.
And finally, Tom, if you believe this market's heading higher not only this year but into next year, how would you play it? Is there a sector that really stands out to you that looks favorable to you on the charts?
Aside from gold, which I'm very bullish on, I would be looking for a resurgence in small cap growth stocks to be the tell that, yes, the liquidity is coming back and that the uptrend is starting. We are not seeing that right now. They are underperforming everybody else, the other three style segments, and that's a message that for right now, liquidity is a problem for the market, and we still have a corrective market going on, which it's supposed to be going on until late October to early November. I would be watching the performance, or lack thereof, of the small cap growth stocks as the tell will say, okay, now it's time to get back and go on. And those tend to do the best during uptrends, partly because of the inherent higher beta that they have, but also because they're more liquidity sensitive. And if we're going to see the comeback in liquidity that I'm expecting to have starting in November, they should be the ones that do the best.
Well, listen, Tom, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they can easily do so.
Jim, I always appreciate you asking me that. I would love it if people want to come check us out at our website, which is mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of McClellan Oscillator. There's two L's in oscillator. Or just do a Google search on Tom McClellan and you'll find us. There's a whole free Learning Center section with lots of articles, probably a book length worth of articles in there that people can wander around and take a look at all for free. Or they can check out the good stuff in our subscription products. We have a twice monthly newsletter for $195 a year. We have a daily edition that's $160 per quarter or $600 a year. We can even have a 2-week free trial on the daily edition so you can sign up and take a look without risk.
Tom, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. If I'm going to bet on the election, I may have to call you or read your letter a week before. Anyway, thanks, my friend. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you, Jim.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The key thing for investors to watch right now is what is taking place in global bond markets. So says Peter Bukvar, chief market analyst at the Lindsay Group and the co-chief investment officer at Bookmark Advisors, who joins us today. Peter, I want to talk to you about this piece that you wrote last month. The title of it being "The Canary in the 35-Year Bond Bull Market is Singing." And you say that you're throwing your weight into the call that we've now seen a bottom in global interest rates and a top in bond prices. Tell us what you're looking at and why this is so important.
Well, after the Brexit vote, we saw another leg down in interest rates as there was this flight to anything with yield, and negative interest rates went further negative. And the Japanese 40-year JGB, to use that as an example, went down to 7 basis points. And then as we got further into August, it started to become apparent that the damage being done to the banking systems in Japan and in Europe in particular was damaging to the point where it backed central banks off this desire to have not only negative interest rates, but flat as a pancake yield curves. So the Bank of Japan started to buy less longer term JGBs to see if they can sneak in some steepening of the curve. That was formalized when they met not too long ago and they talked about yield curve control. Now, rewind, I always thought that we were in an epic bond bubble, and what was going to eventually take away the printing press from central banks would have been higher inflation. But what seems to be right now, it was the damage to the bank stocks that was the first thing to sort of take away this printing press, particularly in Japan, and now we're seeing signs in Europe. Now, they're still obviously printing away. But I think in terms of their acknowledgement that we've now crossed the Rubicon and that there's outright damage being done to the banking systems, and how can you have a healthy economy when your banks are getting hurt to the extent that they are? And because we're all in this bond bubble together, the rise in rates in Japan spilled over into Europe, spilled over into the UK, and then spilled over into the US. Then you throw in the sharp decline in the pound. So now the inflation pressures are now rising in the UK. You have commodity prices that are showing clear signs of bottoming, particularly oil prices. And we've recycled out the sharp declines in energy prices, and headline inflation numbers should start to move higher. So taking this all together was the gist of my piece last month. And I think the low in yields in mid-July, we may never see again in our lifetimes.
Well, the dollar continues to strengthen. What will that mean for U.S. markets, U.S. profits, and what about other currencies where central banks are talking about loosening, more QE, and the Fed is talking about tightening? Joining me on the program is Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman. Mark, before we be getting into what the Fed may or may not do and how it impacts the dollar, I wonder if you might briefly touch upon what happened to the pound a couple Fridays ago when the pound actually experienced a flash crash.
Yeah, sure. So by flash crash, what I think a lot of people mean is just a sudden, sharp movement, usually adverse movement in a currency or a bond or a stock. And that's what we saw happen on sterling. It was October 7th. And put this in perspective for you. You go home the night of October 6th, and the sterling is trading 126. And in early Asia, so remember, one of the cool things I think about the foreign exchange market is truly a 24-hour market. And that is to say, in the U.S. afternoon, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, Australia and New Zealand are coming online. And then around 7 or 8 o'clock, Japan comes online. And that's the 24-hour day. Despite what some of my friends might think, the sun does not rise and set in the U.S., but the 24-hour day begins long before the U.S. wakes up and finishes at the end of our session, 5 o'clock. So in this early Asian session, before Tokyo opens up, which is the largest financial center there still, it's very thinly traded. You don't have a lot of banks watching the market or operating in the market, and particularly thin time for foreign exchange. And that's when oftentimes you have serious moves. But this move on sterling was just incredible. Like I said, you go home the night before, you're trading 126. That early in Asia, we didn't really get much above 126 and a quarter. And we fell sharply. How sharply? Well, there's a lot of disagreements because unlike stocks, there's, at any given time, there's one price for IBM stock or Amazon or Apple. But currencies, they do not have a central trading place, and there can be lots of prices at the same time, various platforms. It's also become a very fragmented market. So Bloomberg has the low Friday of October 7th, 118.41. Remember, you went home that previous night at 126. That's an 8-cent move.
Explain how big of a deal that is. You know, you think, well, $1.26 to $1.18. But that's big when something like that happens in the currency markets.
Yeah, so usually a day's range in sterling might be a cent, cent and a half. Occasionally, a big day would be a 2-cent move. So here we had something that's four or five times bigger, and that might also minimize what really happened. Some platforms had us not stopping at 118.40, the way Bloomberg quotes it, but some machines, some platforms actually traded below 115. That was about 11-cent move on what a currency that's about the fourth most actively traded currency in the world. And so the magnitude of the move is probably one of the largest. Of course, we had the Brexit when the UK had a referendum on June 23rd. But leaving that aside, this is one of the biggest moves that we saw on October 7th, and this happened all within about 10 minutes. This is what concerns people. This is what concerns participants as well as policymakers, and they are trying to investigate. That is, the Bank of England has called for the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, to help investigate what actually took place. But I'd say for a lot of your listeners, the key point is that you can have some big moves that are not necessarily triggered by fundamentals. It might have something to do with the microstructure of the market, fewer participants, prop traders, at banks being squeezed out with the Volcker Rule, various things, the technology allowing for a fragmented market. And there also seems to be a macro market explanation too, which is the central banks through quantitative easing essentially dampens volatility. So think about a summer day, many summer days. It's quiet, nice breeze, and then all of a sudden you get a summer storm. The summer storm is a function of how calm things were. Similarly, in the foreign exchange market and in the global capital markets, you have periods of stability, partly because central banks are depressing volatility by buying bonds, and many countries are buying stocks as well. I think about China, I think about the Japanese, I think about the Swiss National Bank. And so we had like a summer storm, and I think that both micro explanation as well as a macro explanation probably is needed to understand why we have these things. Sterling is just the most recent case. We've had sharp moves in Japanese yen. We've had sharp moves in U.S. treasuries. We've had sharp moves in New Zealand dollar and South African rand. So we've seen these before, but typically what makes this different with sterling is that typically the other currencies have gone back to instruments. Have gone back to what I'd call status quo ante. You have a big move, inexplicable move, and it snaps back to where it was before. Not so in sterling. Since sterling broke down from that 126 on the night of October 6th, we have not been above 124.75. That's been the high. And this week, the low has been about 121.80. So we're still working our way down, and I think that this flash crash, partly as investors, we should be prepared for this, which is why I think that we'd agree that there's no substitute for risk management. People like me try to be right. We make a lot of, say, informed guesses. But even if we're, no matter what, whether we're right or wrong, there's still no substitute for disciplined risk management.
And when you take something like that, and a lot of our listeners are familiar with technical analysis, when you break down on a chart, doesn't that get further weakness? In other words, when you go through key technical support levels, and certainly, you know, as you mentioned, in some trading screens, the pound got down to $1.15, and I heard 1.13. I don't know if that's true or not. But when you break through technical support levels, doesn't that beget more weakness?
Well, you would think so. That is to say that the market's trend, and one big down move is followed by another big down move. I'd say that what I found most interesting is both on the night of the UK referendum and then again on that October 7th. So I look at the futures market because the spot market's not always, we don't always know what people are positioned, how people are positioned in the spot market. In the futures market, people have to declare whether they're commercials, have underlying business need, or whether they don't have the underlying business need, meaning that they're non-commercials or speculators. And so I had thought that both on the night of the UK referendum and again on October 7th, that a lot of people who were long sterling in the futures market would have been stopped out. They weren't. And that tells me that a lot of people then, a lot of traders, are not playing with stops, that they have other ways of risk management. Could be options. It could be a calendar spread where you're long sterling in for December and short sterling for March. There's a lot of different ways to manage the risk. But it doesn't seem that a lot of the futures participants, speculators in the futures markets, non-commercials, were using stops. They were not stopped out.
So let's talk about the dollar then in relation to some of these other currencies. We've seen it strengthen recently. And I don't know if that's a reflection as the Fed has basically hinted to the market. And I think the futures market indicates that there's a greater than 60% probability that they raise in December. So we have this divergence where you have the Fed, despite some of the weakness that we've seen in economic numbers, still talking about tightening. So one has to scratch your head and think, well, you know, the economy is cruising along at a 1% rate, which could be a stall speed. And they're talking about raising rates and the rest of the world isn't, because when the Fed does something like raise rates, as we saw them do last December, it has repercussions globally.
I would take a little step back from that. Here's how I sort of think the Federal Reserve is thinking about it. And I'd say that when we think about the Federal Reserve, there's a lot of regional presidents. There's 12 regional presidents. And last month, nine of the 12 regional Fed presidents asked for a discount rate increase. Not the same as the Fed funds increase. It's a little bit different. The regional Fed presidents can request it to the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve. They decide it's not a binding recommendation. But it tells you that 9 of the 12 want to see a rate hike. Why would the Fed raise rates? You say, well, the economy is hardly growing. And I say, well, I'm not so sure that we're just growing 1%. I kind of think we're growing closer to 2% or say 1.5% to 2%. But you say, well, even that's kind of slow. Remember when we used to be growing 3%? Well, I think that is one of the key developments this side of the crisis, and especially in the last couple of years. The Federal Reserve's dot plots show that they think that the trend growth, and by trend growth, they mean the rate of growth that's consistent with full employment full use of our resources, non-inflationary. They say that growth level, that trend growth in the U.S. is now 1.8%. So not only then is the Federal Reserve close to its dual mandate of price stability, which they define as 2% inflation, core PCE, we're about 1.6, and near full employment, measured by the conventional unemployment rate, but sensitive to other measures as well. And they say we're reaching close to full employment, we're reaching close to our price stability, and the economy is growing not far from trend. So the prudent thing to do then is to say that the low rate we have now, which is 25 to 50 basis points, this is still like intensive care. The U.S. economy has shown that even though it's not amazing growth, it's still close to trend growth, and the prudent thing to do, it seems to me, is still to be slowly raising interest rates, provided that not an urgency, but just sort of gradually raising interest rates to help reduce some of the risks caused by low interest rates and to help the Federal Reserve be prepared or sort of to be able to reactivate, if they need to, conventional monetary policy. So I think that the market has shifted. I've been writing it in my commentary since about mid-September, thinking that the market has been shifting from focusing on different things like oil prices to focusing on interest rates and interest rate differentials. So in my work, I show that the Canadian dollar, for example, more sensitive to the two-year U.S.-Canada interest rate differential than to oil prices. I say the same thing about the Japanese yen. Seems to be more sensitive to U.S. interest rates, Fed policy, than they are to the stock market. Today's a good example of that. The U.S. stock market is down. The S&P 500 is down 8 points now as we're talking. And you'd expect with heavier stocks that for the yen to be stronger, but it's not. Dollar yen's back above 104 on the highs of the day. And I think this is because people do expect the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. I think that those Fed funds futures contracts are probably underestimating it, partly because, you know, many people like myself, we've been burned before many times. Think about this. A year ago, or I should say last December, the Fed told us maybe 4 hikes might be appropriate this year. Then they said 2, and now they're saying 1. And so a lot of people, I think, have lost faith in being able to read sort of the Fed's tea leaves. But I do think the Fed's going to raise interest rates in December. I've penciled in my forecast 2 rate hikes for next year. And I think that the dollar is going to continue to broad trend basis, dollar trends higher. And I think that the higher the euro goes against sterling, the more the euro is going to have to fall against the dollar because of the trade-weighted tightening aspect that that gives to the eurozone. I do agree with you. ECB likely to extend its QE, and they'll likely make that decision in December. BOJ, not so clear if they're in a hurry to do anything more right now. They're still being very aggressive. There's probably still a scope for the Bank of England to cut interest rates, maybe next month, but maybe not until early next year. But I think you're right that other countries are cutting interest rates or easing monetary policy while the Fed raises them. But so far, the impact on the dollar is still quite marginal.
So as we look at this, is there a possibility? I know when the Fed kind of led the markets last year, almost similar to a repeat this year, where they were going to raise, then they weren't going to raise, they went a pass, and then finally in December last year, they raised. But I think they were surprised, Mark, by what we saw unfold in the first 6 weeks of this year.
Sure, I think that they were surprised, but I don't think that they view it as a function of what the Fed did. Because remember what happened in January, we come back from the first day of the new year, the Nikkei, the German DAX, and the U.S. S&P 500 all gapped lower at the open. Why? Is it because the Fed raised rates in the middle of December 2015? I don't think so. I don't think the Fed thinks so. I think that at that time, like last August 2015, it was a China story. And that's really the dog that hasn't barked this year. After January, the market has become much more immune to developments in the Chinese currency and the Chinese stock market. That is over. And I think the fact that that has passed helps make it more likely that the Fed raises interest rates because the global climate, we've survived Brexit. We've survived the Chinese stock market, still one of the poorest stock markets of the year. The Chinese currency is new multi-year lows, and yet the global capital markets have been fairly smooth, leaving aside the flash crash and these kind of things from time to time.
So, Mark, if you expect the dollar to continue to rise, and we know that much of the S&P is made up of international companies, likewise with the Dow, do you expect that to have adverse impact on, let's say, corporate earnings? In other words, if I'm Coca-Cola or I'm Procter & Gamble, I'm selling stuff overseas in euros or Japanese yen, and the dollar strengthens, when I translate those sales and those profits back into U.S. dollars, they're worth less.
Yes, I have big crocodile tears for corporate America. They've been seeing earnings fall while the dollar has been softening. And of course, when they do report these earnings, I mean, Q3 earnings are really behind us. So we're really talking about Q4 earnings now. I think that a couple of things to think about. One is that corporations have various tools and privileged accounting treatment for properly hedging themselves. And hedging works as long as the markets are moving slowly and gradually, which allows hedgers, corporate treasurers, to adjust their positions. And this is why I think the pace of the move is more important than the level of the move. Secondly, I'd say that the U.S. companies do not service these foreign markets primarily by exporting. That's the old European answer. That's the German answer. That's the Finnish answer. That's the Swedish answer. It's not the American answer. The American answer is to service foreign demand, it's better for everybody concerned to build locally and sell locally. So, for example, if Europe is having a slow patch, does that affect GM in Detroit? Not so much as GM in Europe. And so I think that it's true what you say, that what we call this is translation exposure, as they translate their foreign earnings into dollars. But remember, we're talking about the S&P 500 companies, and many of them keep those profits overseas because they say they don't want to pay 35% tax. And I'd suggest that most of them don't pay 35% tax anyways. There are so many loopholes. And regardless of who gets elected president of the United States, I think both candidates have suggested or hinted that they would consider a tax holiday. So I do think that, the Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Fisher addressed this when someone asked him a similar type of question. He said corporate profits are coming off of record high levels. Some adjustment was going to be necessary. It was inflated by, in the past, the weak dollar. And so I'd want to look at this not just quarter over quarter, which I know a lot of equity investors insist on, but to really see the economic impact of a rising dollar, I wouldn't necessarily look at simply at corporate profits. I'd want to look at a broader development and see corporate profits not quarter over quarter, but what's the bigger picture trend? And the problem in the United States, like in many countries, is what we call insufficient aggregate demand. Our bosses, our employers, have basically had a choice. They say, we've had some productivity gains, and how should we distribute them? How much of it should go to wages, and how much of it should go to profits? And they have taken the lion's share of this. And so if there's a pushback and we have some higher wages or higher costs for them, isn't this part of the solution? Profits too high, and corporations have so much money they don't know what to do with it. So what are they doing with it? They're buying back their own stock. So bottom line here for you, I don't think that a strong dollar, and it's very gradual increase in the dollar, I don't think that is the main problem that corporate America has. I think they have other challenges. Insufficient aggregate demand would be on the top of my list of their challenges. And so I do think as long as the dollar's rise is gradual, that corporations can cope with it, even though, of course, they're going to whine about it.
So given this, the market up until this time, and especially after Brexit, I think a lot of people got surprised in the market. We went from kind of this cautionary market where you had risk off trades, things like staples, utilities, telecoms doing well, to a risk on trade. Do you see that changing with the coming Fed rate hike? Or do you think that despite that, the market plows ahead and we stay with this risk on trade?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I think when it comes to like what is driving the stock market, and I think about not just the U.S. stock market, which is up about 5.25% this year, which is among the better performing within the G10. The DAX is up close to us. And of course, Canada's having a relatively good year too, up 7% over the past year. So I think to myself, why is the stock market up here? It's obviously not earnings momentum. And by most measures, the U.S. stock market looks a bit rich on, like, say, one-year forward-looking P.E. ratios. So I think, like many investors, in the back of my mind, I have two models. One model is based on fair value, whether it's breakup value, P.E. ratios, free cash flow, what have you. The other model is based on liquidity. And I think that is what's driving the markets right now. Generally speaking, equity markets elevated. Why? Primarily because central banks are keeping interest rates low. They're buying bonds, forcing other investors elsewhere. So, for example, one of the things I think is important to like illustrate this point is the yield of the S&P 500. That yield right now, if you just buy the S&P 500 and you get no capital gains, stock market doesn't move, what do you get? 2.15%. What do you get by if you buy a U.S. 10-year bond? 1.75%. So you pick up 40 basis points, you take more risk, for sure, but you get a better yield, plus you have capital gain appreciation potential. So that's why I think that the stock market's being held up because the interest rates are so low, it's more of a competitive asset. That works for the U.S. I think that, for example, in the U.K., where the FTSE 100, where they get a lot of their profits, like you say, for the S&P 500 from overseas. So in the U.K., the FTSE 100 is really a proxy for the currency. So as the currency falls, their foreign earnings are worth more sterling. And so that FTSE 100 is up roughly 10% this year. Other countries have different stories. What I'm looking at right now is really about how foreigners have been selling Japanese stocks. We went on a big buying binge with the beginning of Abenomics. And in the last, I want to say 4 out of the past 5 months, foreigners have been selling Japanese stocks. And of course, when they sell Japanese stocks, what happened to a lot of investors is they bought a basket of Japanese stocks and hedged out the currency. So as they sell Japanese stocks, they're not selling the yen. They've got to buy back their hedge.
So given this, would you stay with the risk-on trade, or would you be beginning to maybe take some profits and hedge? Because just as we saw in the pound, and as a currency trader, you always know that you have hedges out there because sometimes markets can surprise you in ways you don't expect.
Yeah, I tell you the truth, Jim, I'm nervous about the stock market at these levels, even if it is because of liquidity. Most of this year, I've been, my own personal account's been about a 50% cash. I don't really see changing that yet. What I'm looking at really, leaving aside the, you know, I do recognize the liquidity story, and that's got another 6 months, maybe another year to play out. But I'm concerned that the U.S. yields are going to be rising. What I've been arguing for our clients is that it looks to me like, leaving aside Japan, but in Europe and the U.S., and many other countries, inflation looks like it's bottomed. And as inflation bottoms, that'll fuel inflation expectations and fuel higher yields. And I think that might sap some of the strength in the stock market. So I'm watching that carefully. I'm not looking for a big drop in the stock market. I'm just looking for it to cheapen up a little bit and have maybe a year-end correction.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Sure. I have a blog that bank is letting me experiment with called Mark to Market. That's Mark with a C for my mom's sake. That's www.marctomarket.com. I'm also on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is Mark Making Sense, which really comes from my first book published by Bloomberg called Making Sense of the Dollar. I can tell you, Jim, and your listeners, that I will have a new book coming out probably in middle of February called Political Economy of Tomorrow.
Well, Mark, when that comes out, be sure to contact me. I'd love to talk to you about that book as well as read it.
Great. Thank you.
Last of the presidential debates took place this week, and you know we've covered economic issues the last couple of months, especially the leading economic indicators, indicating that the economy is actually approaching stalling speed, which will have some major political impacts next year. But you would never know that from what was discussed at the various presidential debates, including the debates this week. No one seems to be talking about it on Wall Street either, and certainly not in the debate. So we'll discuss what all of these issues are and what that means for investing coming up next during The Big Picture. And also, why is it so many people are drinking the Kool-Aid from the mainline media? It was tabloid journalism for the most part on the part of what used to be a lot of respected outlets that drove much of the debate content. Again, to the ignoring of those things that are really significant. All of that being discussed next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his portfolio managers, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Greetings, everyone. John Loeffler here. You know, quite often you hear Jim and me discuss on the Financial Sense NewsHour what we call the new normal. But what does that all mean in the real world when it comes to navigating the world's markets and economies in what seems to be a new and steadily changing environment? Well, answering that question is the purpose of our Investment Strategy Conference, which is taking place on October 29th in San Diego. The theme of this year's conference is Approaching the Peak and the Next Financial Crisis. For more information on attending the Investment Strategy Conference and getting this information, that will be October 29th at the Del Mar Marriott in San Diego, contact us at 858-487-3939. Once again, that's 858-487-3939. 487-3939, or you can email Crystal at crystal@paplava.com. That's Crystal, C-R-Y-S-T-A-L, at paplava.com. Just because things are changing doesn't mean you have to be an uninformed or anxious investor.